For most of this century, there has been a single story about global food security, that food insecurity existed outside U.S. borders, in low and middle-income countries. And in these countries, food producers themselves were the most food insecure of anyone. This single story lent itself to a simple policy solution: increasing agricultural production in developing countries. It is still incredibly important to do this, but not only this. As demographics change, as geopolitics shift, as the world wrestles with the COVID pandemic, and as climate change causes temperature and weather extremes worldwide, today's food insecurity requires new solutions. Have policymakers kept up, or are they relying on yesterday's answers? Welcome to the Reset the Table podcast, where we'll make room at the table for fresh ideas for solving food insecurity around the world and right here at home. I'm turning over the mic to the CSIS Global Food Security Program for today's episode.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the CSIS Reset the Table podcast series. My name is Kimberly Flowers. I'm your guest host today, and we will be talking about antimicrobial resistance, in particular talking about it in low and middle income countries and thinking about its connections to One Health, and most importantly, thinking about solutions. What is this? What does it mean? And what are ways that people are working on it to make it better? And we have two extraordinary experts going to be talking with us today. I feel like they are each other's doppelgangers in different countries because they have a lot in common. Both of them are professors, they are veterinarians, they are microbiologists, they work on research, and they hold leadership positions in a number of centers or institutes working on microbial resistance. So we have with us today Dr. Paul Plummer. Paul is a professor at Iowa State University. He is a veterinarian. He is also the executive director of the National Institute of Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education. And he's currently working on some USAID or USDA-funded projects in East Africa. But he's been working on this area for quite some time. We also have with us today Anders Dalsgaard. He is also a veterinarian and microbiologist who's been working on this in research for over 25 years. He works predominantly in low and middle income countries, especially Southeast Asia and East and West Africa. He's also a consultant with ICARS, the International Center for Antimicrobial Resistance Solutions, and also is a professor at the University of Copenhagen. Thank you both very much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Same here. Thanks a lot, Kimberly.
We're so glad to have you. So you may be doing well, but as the world, how are we overall doing with antimicrobial resistance? Is everything going well in that area?
Well, I think actually in some aspects we are. I mean, we see a lot of commitment around the world. We see more or less every single country, also in the low and middle income countries. We see governments putting in efforts to set up their national action plans. They collect a lot of data. They do all their best, actually, in a lot of places to at least create the basis for doing something.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Paul? Are we on the right track in terms of thinking about antimicrobial resistance in general?
Well, I think we're certainly doing a good job of raising awareness and, you know, as Anders said, really working with countries to identify ways that they can move forward in this process. And I do agree that that's the important component of this. You know, I tell my students on a regular basis, the important thing that we got to think about is every day when we go to use antibiotics, we ask ourselves, how can we do this better? And if all antibiotic prescribers, users, and folks, you know, all of us take antibiotics when necessary, if each of those times we asked, how can we do this better? Are we doing this the best we can? Then we continue that positive trajectory and continue to make progress.
Let's start by taking a step back for a minute, especially since you're both professors and I now work at a college too. So I'm thinking about college students often. How do you explain to the students that you work with what even this issue is? So for a student that is brand new to antimicrobial resistance, and we can refer to it as AMR in this podcast if you prefer, but what do you talk to them about the issue in general of what it is and what they should be thinking about it, particularly in terms of low and middle income countries? If you were talking to your students, if you do antimicrobial resistance 101, what do you say?
So at the most basic level, antimicrobial resistance is when a microbe, a pathogen or a bacteria that used to be killed by an antibiotic now develops the ability to resist that attack. When these microbes develop the ability to withstand antibiotic treatment, continue to live and continue to cause disease as a pathogen. And so at its most basic level, antimicrobial resistance is a failure of our antibiotics to kill the microbes that they used to kill.
Anders, how do you explain this to someone who's new to the topic?
We talk about that we often take antibiotics for granted. So I often try and tell the story, actually giving a lot of example. I mean, even going back, you know, to the World Wars and really showing how antibiotics have made a difference. I mean, people were dying by the millions of simple infections and suddenly they could be treated. If we go to hospitals, all of us, a simple surgery, we will have some prophylactic antibiotics so we can do surgeries. I mean, all these things we seem to take for granted, but with the increasing resistance, in particular, actually, at our hospitals, you know, we are actually, and it sounds crazy, but we are at the stage where the saying is actually true that if you want to stay healthy, you better get out of the hospitals. So hospital infections are really killing a lot of people at the moment. And it's simply because a lot of these bugs, bacteria causing main diseases and are spreading at our hospitals, we hardly can't treat them anymore.
And how does this sort of play out differently in different places in the world? So, you know, I think climate change is on a lot of people's minds right now, and we certainly have seen a lot of conversation about who's responsible for it or how it's impacted, you know, other countries, you know, sort of the West versus the developing world. So how is antimicrobial resistance different in low and middle income countries? How does that look different than, say, in the United States, Paul?
Well, there's a variety of different ways that impact the face of antimicrobial resistance, both in human and in environmental and animal health. Certainly, we all recognize that antimicrobials are critically important, as Anders pointed out, to maintaining the health and welfare of humans and animals in disease states. But at the same time, we don't need to use antibiotics for everything. And so there becomes these context-specific issues that really raise differences in the challenges that we face with antimicrobial resistance. This ties into food safety. This ties into food security for sure. And as we think about low and middle income countries where resources may be different than what we have in developed countries, and cold chain veterinary services and the availability of veterinary services, and even access to preventive care, vaccines and or antibiotics themselves, all of those differences in low and middle income countries impact the face of antimicrobial resistance. And certainly local disease context also impacts that. We see different diseases in different parts of the world, and those all impact our antimicrobial use and our antimicrobial resistance.
Is it just about money then? Do they just need more money in their budgets to purchase, you know, the right kinds of medicines and equipment? Or what do you think?
I think obviously it is to some extent about resources. It is also about having these drugs available. I mean, they need to have access to them. They need to be there, which may not be the case or often is not the case. But obviously, in the first place, the infection occurs within the hospital because the infection and prevention control measures within these hospitals' environments are far less controlled, and you have much more transmission than we see at our hospitals. I mean, we have lots of data showing, for example, that if one out of 10 patients are positive, you know, upon admission at a hospital for a particular very highly resistant bacteria, within 2 weeks, you know, this has spread within the hospital. So you may have 80% of people now carrying these pathogens that in some days' time may actually cause serious infections. And that is, of course, due to hygiene measures within the hospital are different. They are inadequate. And there are a lot of factors that can explain why this is happening.
What do you think, Paul?
Building on what Anders was discussing there, it even goes back to having a safe, secure water supply. We spend a huge amount of effort here in the United States focusing on hand hygiene in human hospitals and veterinary hospitals. And all of that relies on, plumbing, soap, and the ability to easily wash your hands between patients and after handling some of your diagnostic specimens. When we go into low and middle income countries, even some of the basics of having a readily available clean water supply that allows us to improve hand hygiene can be a challenge. And you build to that the potential for waterborne or foodborne disease transmission and the potential then to increase infections. So I agree entirely with Anders, and it goes back even earlier into the, into the entire infrastructure of the country and availability of safe, secure, and plentiful water and food sources.
So what are some of the solutions that you're working on, Paul, right now, whether it's with USAID and the USDA, funding that you have, or, what are some things that you see that has worked?
Well, I think certainly having discussions with community animal health workers and producers, farmers, small shareholder farmers or pastoralists to help them start to frame up what really is a very complex issue. I mean, we were talking about trying to present this to college students, but when we're interacting with folks that may not even have that level of education because of a lack of resources and infrastructure, then really helping them to think through this process. And so some of the areas that we're working on is certainly to work with local vet schools and veterinary faculty to build in opportunities to do more field work that has an educational component, a sociology component of that, to help these individuals recognize the benefits of intervention on disease prevention and early diagnosis, and in the benefit of working with a community animal health worker or a veterinarian to make treatment decisions. That even goes over to trying to support decision making. And so some app-based opportunities, mobile phone-based opportunities to sort of telemedicine, if you will, in very rural environments to improve kind of decision making around animal health decisions.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting to think about the use of mobile phone and technology and how it's really had an impact on health across the spectrum. Anders, I would love to hear, the International Center for Antimicrobial Resistance Solutions is fairly new. Part of its mission is really focusing on low and middle income countries. So talk to us a little bit about what ICARS is doing and what solutions that you're working on or what you're seeing that's actually making a difference.
The whole start of ICARS was actually some discussions about a bit more than 3 years ago with the World Bank that approached the Danish government. And there was seen a need really for solutions. There was seen need for interventions that could provide change in practice, you could say in the real world, in the different contexts that we see in these low and middle income countries. So ICARS is not, focusing in on collecting a lot of data, surveillance program. ICARS is focusing in on what are the interventions that can mitigate, that can change, for example, reduce a certain antimicrobial use practice. It can be to also more preventive measure. For example, vaccines are central. If you take things like vaccine, we typically have a lot of good documentation that vaccines work. They at a certain level, certain percentage can prevent a disease. But the question often is, why are they not more widely used? So vaccines could be a good example in a poultry sector, like in Tanzania, for example, where ICARS is working on that. Then the support given to that country from ICARS will focus in on, okay, what are the factors? What are the bottlenecks from these vaccines that we know works that are taken up by different poultry producers? And one of these factors, for example, is actually the delivery of quality vaccines. How do you deliver a quality vaccine which has to be called at the point out to a farmer in a rural area where he or she has to use it? Often also, it may be that vaccines are often imported, but they are very highly taxed. So you may work with the government and say, well, if we want vaccine to be used, let's remove the tax. You know, that government is not making a lot of money on import tax because they don't sell a lot of that vaccine at the moment. But if you could remove that taxation, actually, that could contribute to a good business case for the farmer or the local veterinarian to take up these vaccines. Just the last example, I think, which is the prime example of how vaccines can make a difference in, you know, livestock and aquaculture productions. That is the Norwegian salmon industry. You know, Norway today has become the world global producers of salmon. They used literally 10,000 tons of antibiotics if we go back 15, 20 years. Today, they hardly use any antimicrobials. Why? Simply because of vaccines. Of course, they have had other technology developments, but vaccine was the one factor that made the biggest difference for them.
So both of you have brought up the importance of preventative medicine or vaccine, and I can't help but think or ask about how this relates to the global pandemic that we are still in. You know, have you found that the people that you're working with or even the projects you're working on, is there either increased understanding of the need of this or is there increased resistance? I know these are different vaccines, fully get that. But even that word or even just hand washing, have you found anything in terms of how the pandemic has either really helped or really hindered your work in this area, Paul?
I do think that there's some bright lights out of that process. I mean, certainly the pandemic has elevated the understanding and the appreciation, if you will, for One Health and the recognition that, you know, even a human virus could impact our food supply chain. And, you know, really the concept that a meat counter could be bare because of a human virus or you couldn't buy toilet paper. You know, those weren't really concepts that people had really thought through. And so I think it has demonstrated how all of this is interconnected. Human health impacts, you know, meat production, meat sales, it impacts the global supply chain. So I think that's been beneficial. Certainly vaccine technology and the use of vaccines has been brought to the forefront. And perhaps not surprisingly to me, we've seen that almost kind of as a split of both directions. Certainly strong advocates of vaccine like myself and the benefits of that. But I think in some context and in some countries, there's rising concern about vaccine efficacy, and that I think is a challenge as we try and implement even animal vaccines. But RNA technology used for the COVID vaccine, we've been using in animal vaccines for a period of time. And so we know that that technology has benefit and works. And overall, I think the COVID pandemic has afforded opportunity to demonstrate and talk about One Health, vaccination, epidemiology, and now framing up this importance of antimicrobial resistance, which really is a epidemic of similar proportions, a pandemic, if you will, but it's more silent. It's, you know, it's different organisms. They don't all have the same name as SARS-CoV-2. You've got all of these different organisms that Andrew was talking about in a hospital, and they're different names and they're different antibiotics. And so they don't feel the same. But when you lump them into the bucket of failed treatment because of antimicrobial resistance, that is, you know, the pandemic that we face.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've heard, and my own research for this and other events that we've done at CSIS recently on this topic, I kept seeing many times the antimicrobial resistance being referred to as the silent tsunami, which is a pretty scary descriptor. Anders, is there anything you want to add from your experience, especially from, you know, from a European perspective in terms of the pandemic and how that's either helped or hindered your work in this area?
So when it comes to vaccines, we don't see, you know, group of people or farmers that would argue, well, vaccine would harm our animals. They would not grow as well. That will influence reproduction. I mean, you know, some of these arguments we hear in, among us, you know, where people do not want to take the COVID vaccine. I think in the low and middle income countries, there actually is another aspect here. And that is that if we compare the human sector with the veterinary sector, we know pretty well in the human sector the different viral bacterial pathogens that are causing our main diseases. We have characterized them well, and we can develop good vaccines against these specific types and even, you know, subtypes of these pathogens. When it comes to veterinary clinical pathogens, we often have far less knowledge. So if you move into the low and middle income countries, we actually don't know what is causing this weaning diarrhea in the piglets. We assume somehow it's the same so-called E. coli types as we see in our parts of the world. And we sell the vaccine. The farmers in these low and middle income countries can purchase is actually often based on you know, clinical diagnostic work we have done. But it may not be the actual sort of subtypes that are included in the vaccines, you know, that are causing their main diseases. So there is actually a lack of knowledge on veterinary diagnostics and information to found the strong basis for developing, in this case, vaccines. And it's actually a limitations of some of the otherwise, I would say, good work that is being supported globally. You know, we have big players like the UK Fleming Fund that established a lot of surveillance program in many countries. But often there's no focus on also testing what is the susceptibility to certain antibiotics of the main bacteria that are causing respiratory tract infection in the cattle or, you know, in the pigs or vice versa for the diarrhea? Of course, a farmer is and should be concerned about the health of his animals, but often he doesn't know what are causing the diseases among his animals. And therefore, when he has to choose vaccine or somebody have to sell him vaccines, we can't really, in that specific context, provide the most optimal solution to him. And that's a problem.
Yeah, that is. As we wrap up, I want to think about success stories. I like to always end a bit positive because this can feel quite overwhelming, I think, in terms of what this could be and how we manage it and all of the roadblocks along the way. But I'd love to hear some solutions, again, in terms of really context or country-specific things that are working. Is there a country or maybe it's even a community where you have seen some real success in this? And what was the solution that worked in that specific context?
Well, I think there's definitely examples on local context-specific situations where we do see success. I recently had the opportunity to serve on a PhD committee for a veterinarian in Kenya working on antimicrobial resistance and specifically antimicrobial resistance in cattle and mastitis pathogens. And through some behavioral and participatory epidemiology approaches and interactions with a local community, they did have success at raising awareness of antibiotic use, raising awareness of the zoonotic potential, as well as production losses associated with mastitis pathogens. And they were able to move the bubble, if you will, there on that local environment and improving mastitis, improve the health of the animals, and ultimately, because raw milk is commonly sold there, improve the safety of the milk. And so definitely an excellent example in that case in Kenya of a local scale benefit. The challenge becomes, because of the resources and infrastructure, scaling those small scale examples up to a national or even continent scale. And those are the challenges. But I suspect Anders has some other examples that he could tell us about.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I would actually like to move and give an example from a country that we often actually criticize within this space also. And that's actually China. China actually banned the use of colistin in livestock. They did that for some years ago. And, you know, colistin is a drug that traditionally has been used in the pig and also poultry industry historically for many, many years. Then suddenly we saw a lot of resistant development among some of the main human pathogens. And we wanted really to reserve colistin because, you know, colistin could actually treat these human infections. So China actually came out with a countrywide ban. They banned colistin, and they actually had quite strong national data showing what were the resistant levels we had in different bacteria from our livestock. Then they were able, after the ban, clearly to show they had an effective ban, and they actually could measure a clear impact on reduced level of colistin resistance. So this is an example of, if you're able to enforce legislation on a critical, highly critical compound here, but also a compound that is not needed by the livestock industry, because the farmers could replace colistin with something less critical. We want to reserve it for people and treating human infections. But I think that's a very, very promising example. I just want to give one more that is actually with the pig industry, where ICAS is working in Colombia. There is an entity there called Pork Colombia, which is actually representing more than 90% of the pig producers in that country. And actually, through that Pork Colombia, we're trying also to test interventions that actually include vaccines with an industrial organization who represent all the major producers in that country, because they are the one who can deliver the change.
What I like about all of those examples that you gave is that the solution is can be both top down in terms of like major policies and how important it is to connect with the stakeholders, but also how important that local community awareness. But in both of those, it's about research, it's about education. That's really interesting. I think those very different kind of success stories that you've given. So I just want to thank you both. This has been a really interesting conversation. I want to turn back to you one last time just to see if there's any other final message or any other final word that you want to give, especially around as we think about what additional solutions, like what more do we need? Do we need more money? Do we need more research? Do we need, you know, more policymakers to understand this? Do we need more farmers to find this as a priority? What is it that still really needs some more attention on this? Paul, and then Anders, we'll end with you.
Where we need to exert more energy, certainly money helps, resources helps, infrastructure helps, all of that helps. But at the end of the day, even in developed countries, you know, we still have a ways to come in improving our antimicrobial stewardship. And so it's not that infrastructure alone. And so really, I think this comes down to a need to better understand the social sciences, to utilize economics and behavior change, social science and ethics, to really get to the point of understanding people's values and perceptions around antibiotic use, and using that as a means to partner with them, as Anders was talking about, to understand how we can continue to improve this. So for me, social science components of antimicrobial resistance are just as important and need as much or more emphasis as all of the other areas. And that tends to be the one that, for those of us that are veterinarians and microbiologists and not social scientists, that's the one that's a little bit foreign for us and harder for us to grasp.
Anders, your last word?
I think we need to see this more from a business case perspective. So we often hear also in low and middle income countries, all this costs a lot of money. But actually, in a lot of cases, it can be a very strong business case, but we need to have, you know, health system economists. We need to have good economists engaged in, you know, the preparatory work of different interventions and so, because we have very good evidence showing to do different, you know, infection and prevention control at a hospital that actually saves lives and a lot of money for that hospital. It would be the same for livestock, for example. So we need to bring these business case aspects into it. And again, in a wider context, because we can see certain productions around the world, in particular in aquaculture, where they have this reputation, for example, in Asia, that they use a lot of antimicrobials, they have a bad image on certain of these products that are being exported to our parts of the world. So that's also part of a business case, that the price they get at our retail supermarkets may be lower for good or wrong reasons they have this image. So this has to be built into the business case for these farmers as some of the factors why they may change the current practice of use.
Yeah, money is always a good motivating factor for behavior change, especially for farmers. Thank you both so, so much. We really appreciate you joining us today as our guests. And for our audience, that's a wrap for this episode of Reset the Table. We will be taking a break for the holidays, and we will return with more episodes in early 2022. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next year.
This episode was made possible by the generous support from the Royal Danish Embassy.
That's it for today's episode of Reset the Table. You can subscribe on Apple or Spotify and follow us on Twitter @CSIS Food. Until next time.